British Sky Broadcasting, in association with Universal Studios and Gold Circle Films, presents White Noise, audio described by Tony Cook on behalf of the MCS Agency. Nobody knows whether our personalities pass on to another existence or sphere, but if we can evolve an instrument so delicate as to be manipulated by our personality as it survives in the next life, such an instrument ought to record something. Thomas Edison, 1928. Now a picture of modern recording equipment giving way to a fuzzy screen and static. EVP. Electronic voice phenomenon, the recording of voices and images of the dead using detuned receiving apparatus, identified in 1939 and now the subject of increasing scientific research worldwide to finally evidence communication with the deceased. White Noise stars Michael Keaton as Jonathan Rivers, and Deborah Carter Unger as Sarah Tate, also starring Chandra West as Anna Rivers and Ian McNeice as Raymond Price. The music is by Claude Foissy. Under a bright sun and a blue sky with a scattering of fluffy clouds, a large house stands on the headland where two rivers meet. A boat is moored at a pontoon. Now a close-up of a multi-speakered radio cassette player. The radio's on a kitchen table.
Hey, Mikey, you better quit playing and get ready for school. Come on, dude, start eating. Your mom's gonna pick you up in 10 minutes.
He adjusts the aerial.
Hey, were you messing with us?
No.
No. I bet you were. I bet you were fooling around.
I'll get it.
All right.
Hello? Oh, hi, Jane.
Mikey, you want more juice, buddy?
Sure.
Okay. Here you go.
Yeah, no problem. Okay. See ya. Jane can't make it.
Why not?
She didn't say.
Didn't say what?
Your mom can't pick you up this morning.
Does that mean I get to miss school?
No. It means I take you instead. Nice try, Tiger.
He pulls a face at his son.
Was a nice try.
Now in the ensuite bathroom, he cleans his teeth. Through the mirror, he sees his wife dressing in the bedroom. She wears a lace underslip.
Where are you going, baby?
My publishers. They're going to show me the cover.
Wow. You look great.
Thanks.
You look really great. You look really, really great.
You know, John, we're late already. And you have toothpaste on your mouth.
Where?
Right there.
They kiss passionately. She suddenly breaks away and crosses to the bathroom.
You okay?
Yeah.
Smiling, she hides something behind her back.
You sure?
Well, I might be more than okay.
She produces a pregnancy testing kit.
Oh my God in heaven.
Yes!
Yes! Yes!
This could be wrong, so I'll do another one.
Let's go tell Mike's got our brother.
Wait, one step at a time. I'll do another test, and then I'll see the doctor.
Congratulations.
Oh. now outside.
Okay, lunch bag. Soup bag. Kiss. All right, I'll see you in a couple days. Don't forget to say hi to your mom. And you, take it easy.
I know.
They kiss as she sits in her open-top car, his son in the back. She suddenly reverses.
Hey!
They wave goodbye as she turns in the driveway. Jonathan Rivers goes back into the house as his wife Anna drives off. The driveway gates close automatically. A skyline view of a city. At Jonathan's smart architectural offices, a group studies a model of a city centre layout as Jonathan arrives.
Hey, how you doing?
Mr. Rivers?
Hey, Frank asked if you'd call as soon as you're in.
Oh, sure.
Wow.
Wow, what?
You.
What about me?
You're smiling.
Is that a big deal that I'm smiling?
It is on a Monday morning, yeah.
Really?
Really.
Good. Yeah. Oh, hey, Karen.
Yeah.
Order me a bouquet of flowers at the end of the day, okay? Lilies. And champagne. No. Don't give me champagne. Give me chocolates. Big box. Those Belgian kind. You know what I mean? What? What are you looking at now?
Something's up. Something's really up.
Did you just...
I'm going.
Thank you.
I'm going. Okay. But I know something's up.
Frank!
Later, Jonathan's back home with flowers.
Hey, babe, you home?
A toy fire engine is on the floor of the elegantly tiled hallway. He puts his keys on a table and goes into the kitchen, where he hangs his jacket on a door handle. He presses the telephone answering machine.
No.
So I said I'd have a drink with her tonight. Don't worry, I'll stick to water, and I'll call you when I'm on my way home. Oh, did you see the demo cover? What do you think? Hey, I was kind of thinking...
He presses the machine again.
No messages.
He turns on the radio and retunes it. With a puzzled look, he flicks the aerial. The kitchen clock says 6:20. With a glass of red wine, he works at the kitchen worktop on an architectural drawing. He continues working as the hours tick by. He looks increasingly concerned.
Hey, it's Anna. Leave a message after the beep and I will call you back.
Hey, hi, it's me. It's a little before midnight. I guess you're still with Julie. Give me a call, let me know. All right? Love you. Bye. Julie?
Hi, it's John.
Hey, do me a favor. When you get this message, have Anna give me a call, all right? I guess you guys are having a good time. All right, thank you.
The kitchen clock says 2:29. Jonathan sleeps, his head resting on his drawings at the kitchen worktop. He wakes with a start and leaves the kitchen. The bottle of wine he opened earlier is nearly empty. The flowers he brought home are in a glass vase. Slowly returns to the kitchen. Concern is etched on his face. He stands with his hands resting on the worktop, deep in thought. He glances towards the clock on the wall. He sees the second hand has stopped. The clock reads 2:30. Puzzlement sweeps his face. He moves the stool over to the clock and stands on it. As he flicks the clock, the radio on the worktop switches itself on. He turns around with a look of shock. He presses the off switch. Now a photograph of his wife as she appears on the cover of her new book, The Eternal Weight.
Police had discovered the heel of a woman's shoe close to her abandoned car on Argyle Avenue. suggests she may have slipped into the river while attending to a flat tire. Although divers are still searching the immediate area, reported sightings of the best-selling author continue to reach police from towns to cities up to 20 miles away. Police are keeping an open mind as to her whereabouts. Anna River's latest novel, The Eternal Wait, is scheduled for release this fall, and her husband, architect Jonathan Rivers, is said to be taking time out to accompany her on the highly anticipated promotion.
We're gonna get going.
Okay.
Come on, Michael! And Mark will be home in a minute, so...
Okay.
Come on, pal. Say goodbye to your dad.
Come here. Be a good boy. Take care of your mom. Go get your stuff.
Hey, there's a bed at our place if you want it.
Oh, thank you. Jane, look, you don't have to put yourself out for me. I know I wasn't a very good
son. He gives Jane, his first wife, a hug as their son Mike collects his belongings. A tap drips into the sink.
It's 10 days now since international author Anna River's car was found deserted on Argyle Avenue.
Although police still suspect she could have drowned, they are not ruling out the possibility of abduction. Architect husband Jonathan Rivers spoke of his anguish today.
3 weeks since the unexplained disappearance of author Anna Rivers.
They are constructing a profile of a likely abductor.
Distraught husband Jonathan Rivers
had this message for anyone who may know of her whereabouts.
It's difficult that you never give up hope, ever. It's the only way to get by.
A row of large detached houses on the riverside, each flanked by trees and greenery. On the headland where two rivers meet, Jonathan walks from his house to his 4x4, parked in his private driveway. Carrying a long document capsule, he's about to get in when he notices, as the gates open, another 4x4 parked in the road outside the gates. He stares at the vehicle suspiciously before climbing into his car and reversing out of the drive. As he turns the vehicle round, he glances again at the parked car. A portly man sits in the driver's seat. He looks uncomfortable as he notices Jonathan looking at him. Jonathan drives on to work. A bird's-eye view of Jonathan stepping along a wide pavement into his offices.
I got 50 guys and God knows how many thousands of dollars worth of equipment waiting for your go-ahead, so if you want to tell them to wait a month, call me.
He struts with a mobile phone through the open-plan office, dropping paperwork onto the desk of a man who balances a phone between his neck and shoulder. Jonathan turns from a window and then does a double take. Through the window, he sees the portly man sitting on a bench inside the office block. He's reading a newspaper on his lap, but he keeps looking at the offices. With a vexed expression, Jonathan decides on a confrontation. He walks briskly through the open-plan offices, brushing past employees and into the reception area, where architectural designs and paintings are on display. He goes out into the street and across a busy road, where heavy traffic is at a standstill. He approaches the public bench and stands before the portly man, who looks startled.
My goodness, you're outside my house.
I'm sorry.
You were outside my house this morning, and now you're outside my office. So do me a favor, don't insult my intelligence by telling me that's some sort of coincidence.
No, it's no coincidence.
Do I know you?
My name is Raymond Price.
He stands up.
Are you following me?
It's about Anna, Mr. Rivers. I've been receiving messages from her, from the other side.
From what other side?
Jonathan, your wife is dead.
The two men lock eyes before Jonathan walks away dismissively. Price follows him.
I have proof, Mr. Rivers. She's been trying to communicate ever since the moment of her death. Look, Mr. Rivers, my son died when he was 12. For years, I've been suicidal.
Look, just stay away from him. You understand?
But then, someone told me what I've told you. That my son, my dead son, had made contact. And he had, Mr. Rivers. It was true. From the other side. And he was happy. Happy, please. Yes. And also at ease. And it changed my life, Mr. Rivers, because then I knew. So please, please, Mr. Rivers, put this in a drawer, hide it, forget all about it, but please don't throw it away, because one day you will want to know.
He props his business card on the office door.
My thoughts are with you both.
He watches Price cross the road again to where his 4x4 is parked. He glances at the business card. That evening, he views home movies. Anna is on video bringing home shopping.
It's Hannah Rivers. The fabulous Hannah Rivers. Carrying us some groceries.
Stop it.
I was shopping.
Turn it off.
Okay, I'll turn it on. There's one of the best features of Hannah Rivers, right there. That's a beautiful thing, ladies and gentlemen.
As the rain lashes at the bedroom window, he perches in front of the TV. He pauses the video with the remote control as Anna's smiling face fills the screen. His head drops in sadness. Outside, the blue water in the swimming pool shimmers in the moonlight as the bedroom light goes off. Later, a knocking wakes him. He checks the bedside clock. It says 2:30. He walks along the landing, putting his dressing gown over his pajamas. He heads down two flights of stairs, puts the hallway light on, and opens the front door. Two uniformed police officers, a man and a woman, stand there. They remove their hats and step inside.
The body of internationally renowned author Anna Rivers was discovered last night by a security guard making a routine visit to the disused
Pier 16, 3 miles upriver from where her car was found, abandoned 5 weeks ago on Argyle Avenue. The discovery brings to an end...
Mr. Rivers, before she drowned, your wife sustained injuries consistent with a fall onto the rocks by the river. The damage to the head, the break to the arm. When the tide came in, she would have been unable to help herself. She would have been swept upstream several miles. I'm so sorry for your loss.
Standing beside a police car, he surveys the scene where the accident happened.
Divers recovered her personal effects, Mr. Rivers. We found her cell phone in her car, and we're returning it to you.
Thank you for giving her to us, her family and friends. To know and to love as a companion on our earthly pilgrimage. Give us faith to see in death the gain of eternal life, so that with quiet confidence we may continue our course on earth. Until by your call, we are reunited.
At the funeral service, he grips his son's hand. Later, he sits on the bed they shared, forlorn and alone, looking onto the empty landing. Delivery men open the back of their truck and start unloading boxes to a new apartment Jonathan is moving into. The apartment block has a water feature with fountains. It's 6 months later. Mike wiggles the aerial of a portable TV to try to get a good picture.
So, what do you think?
I love it.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's nice here.
All right.
It's a fresh start.
I guess. All right. Could you take my key for the weekend?
Yeah, of course.
Maybe a little longer.
As long as you want, John.
Jane stands with her shoulder bag as he opens boxes. She looks at him with concern on her face. The apartment offers rooftop views of the city from floor-to-ceiling windows. But that night, Jonathan is not ready for the views. He sits on his bed, sobbing, in front of the expansive window where the pale streetlights shine in the distance. The construction site of a factory which stretches high into the city skyline. Workmen in safety hats mill around. Jonathan escorts a dark-suited businessman wearing a safety helmet into an industrial lift.
So when do you want to bring him over?
Well, I'd like to see you this week.
Sure. Fine, it shouldn't be any problem. Let me know.
The lift stops between floors. Lights go out.
You brought me here just to do that, didn't you?
No, I didn't. Let me see what I can do here.
And this is where you tell me you're running over budget, right?
Jonathan fumbles around the controls as the businessman becomes impatient.
Shit! Keep doing that!
I'm sorry, I didn't...
Jonathan stares in disbelief at his mobile phone as the screen says the call is from Anna's cell phone.
Ask them if they have a light.
Jonathan switches off the phone and the lift lights come on at the same time.
You guys okay?
We are now.
Yeah.
I trust you'll fix this before Mr. Cunningham arrives.
They get out in the basement where a workman stands with a trowel. Jonathan dashes to his new apartment and runs upstairs to the bedroom. He opens a drawer where Anna's personal effects are kept in the plastic bag the police gave him. He takes out Anna's cell phone, and as he examines it, his own phone rings. The same message is on the screen, Anna's cell phone, but he knows it can't be because he's holding it. As he grips both phones, his mouth drops it. As a new realization sweeps his face, his eyes widen as he puts the phone to his ear and takes the call. He continues to hold the phone to his ear for a few moments, his mouth open in bewilderment. Then he studies both phones before slumping down on his bed in utter shock. Through the undrawn curtains of his bedroom window, the nighttime city traffic can be seen moving in the distance. Now a close-up of an electric light bulb that's switched off. There's darkness. As Jonathan sleeps, his eyelids move. An eye flickers open, and suddenly he's awake. He scrambles out of bed and rushes downstairs to check the answer phone, which is flashing red on the message button.
You have one message. Message received Wednesday, 23rd, 2:30 a.m.
The kitchen clock says 2:30 and 20 seconds. He gives up trying to recall the message. His eyes are wide with shock. He covers his face with his hands. He stares again at the answering machine, which shows a zero for no messages. He leans, as if transfixed, against the kitchen worktop, deep in confused thought. In the morning, he visits a substantial house surrounded by trees. A flower is engraved on the glass in the door. A 4x4 vehicle is parked outside.
Please, come. How nice. Hello.
Hi. Look,
I was just about to finish up with someone.
Oh, but, I can come back.
No. It won't take long. I'm really glad to see you. I was hoping that you'd come.
Thank you.
Oh, this is Sarah Tate. Let me introduce you to Mr. Rivers.
Sorry, I'm a little...
We've had a breakthrough today.
It's incredible. It truly is. This is ridiculous.
Stay a while.
No, I'm fine. I should get these boxes back.
Sarah, no. There's no need to hurry. Make yourself a cup of tea.
I suppose. Thank you. Would you like one?
Yeah. That'd be great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Rivers, please.
He leads him into his study containing recording equipment.
Excuse me. Please, sit here.
He sits at a desk with a TV.
So, have you heard of EVP, Mr. Rivers?
No.
I'm not surprised. I mean, those that have cause cracks. EVP stands for Electronic Voice Phenomenon.
I'm listening.
Well, I'm not a clairvoyant. I'm not a medium. I don't contact the dead. The dead contact me. And with EVP, I can hear them, I can see them, and I can record them.
He presses the play button on a video machine. A fuzzy, indistinct picture appears on the monitor. There are flashing lines and vague shapes.
That's right, yes. People that have passed over.
Price switches the monitor off with a remote control and stands up.
Is this your job or your hobby or what?
I think obsession would be more appropriate, Mr. Rivers. Now, I wonder why that... here we are. Now, they don't always appear visually the first few times. We tend only to pick up their voices, and people can find that frustrating. But when it works, and you see the faces of the people that you're able to help, you know, like Sarah, nothing, believe me, nothing comes close. Mr. Rivers, do you want to hear your wife?
He's placed a mini-disc into a player. He stares quizzically at Jonathan. Jonathan is overcome by emotion and sobs into his hand. Price raises a hand to comfort him, but withdraws it uncertainly. Sarah arrives with two cups of tea.
Frustrating thing about EVP is it's not live. You need to make the recording and then you'll only know if you've got results when you play it back.
Here, it has milk.
Perfect, thank you.
If you both excuse me for a moment.
It's an amazing feeling, isn't it?
It's indescribable.
Yeah, it took me a few visits to get used to it, but now it's addictive. I mean, I'm here all the time, but he's really helped me. And I try to help him when I can, so I keep some of this stuff at the store.
What store?
I have a bookstore. Your wife was a wonderful writer, Mr. Rivers.
Yeah. So, what made you come here?
My fiancé. He died 8 months ago. We've been having some trouble deciphering what he's been saying on the tapes, but this afternoon we cracked it. Only two words. Sarah, yes. Because before he died, he promised me that if it was like, you know, they say it is, that he would find a way of getting to me and letting me know that he's happy. So, Sarah, yes.
Huh.
Raymond thinks we probably won't see him again now, but that's okay. And I've heard what I wanted to hear.
He looks at Sarah as she stands with her tea in a glass, her blonde hair falling over her shoulders. Then he glances at a photograph of Raymond Price with his hand on a young boy's shoulder. Now it's night time, and the rain falls on the glass effect apartment block where Jonathan lives. An elevator ascends in a see-through lift shaft. Jonathan sits at a table with a radio cassette player. He puts in a tape and presses record.
This is John. If there's any way you can hear me, will you please let me know? Please. Just any kind of sign. Please.
The rain clears as dawn breaks. Jonathan is still trying to make contact. He's now in the kitchen, still with the radio cassette, as he eats a hurried breakfast. He grabs his car keys from the table and is off. He puts a cassette in the player as he drives. At his office, he stares from a window and listens on earphones. In his car again, he plays another tape. He thinks he's getting something. He turns up the volume and concentrates. He narrowly avoids a head-on collision by not looking where he was going. Behind him, a car is skew-whiff in the road. He regains his composure and goes on to Raymond Price's house.
I recorded this a few hours ago. It's quite faint, so I had to save it as a sound file onto the computer hard drive to enhance the sound.
So, she knows that I visited?
I believe so, yes.
So, will I get to see her this time?
No. This will just be sound. I'm sorry, John. We have to be a little patient, that's all. Trust me, John. This is just the beginning. Sit here. Now, if you want to hear it again, just press that key. I'll be back in a moment.
He presses the replay button. The lights flicker. He turns and for an instant he sees three grey figures approaching him. He stares around the room in disbelief. In one corner, a reel-to-reel tape recorder monitors continuously. The lights from what appears to be car headlamps shine briefly through the curtain windows. Price returns and stops the machine.
Who was that?
It's okay. There really are some very bad people out there. But you just have to press that, and they're all gone.
We've had another step towards visual contact with Anna. Let's celebrate that, eh? Here.
They can't all be nice. They can't all be Anna.
Price knocks back his glass of white wine.
Oh, yes.
Back at his apartment, the radio cassette switches itself off. As the tape runs out, Jonathan presses the tape release.
Hello. Yeah. Really? I'm on my way.
He pulls up at the home of Raymond Price. He gets out of the car and glances towards the house. He looks surprised when he sees it's in total darkness, even though it's nighttime. Jonathan walks to the front door and peers through the glass where a flower's engraved. When he knocks, the door opens. His look of surprise turns to caution. He slowly steps into the house.
Hello. Raymond?
He sees the door of the study slightly open. There's some light in there coming from computers, monitors, and recording equipment. He looks apprehensive as he slides the door fully open. The room looks a shambles. Smoke rises from some of the equipment. A monitor shows a white fuzzy picture and vague distorted images among the fuzz. He looks down to an overturned monitor, and there on the floor is the dead body of Price, his hand fixed in an upward posture as if he were trying to defend himself. Later, a wheeled stretcher arrives for Price's body. Jonathan stands inside a yellow police tape with a casually dressed detective who hands him a card.
So, you'll tell me whatever you find out, huh?
I can't tell you any more than you'll read in the papers. But if you can think of anything else, here, call me.
Yeah, thanks.
Jonathan watches through the window of the house with his arms folded as crime scene officers take photographs. Now the upper gallery of a bookstore. Sarah Tate stands on steps studying shelves of Price's files and boxes.
By the way, thank you for coming to this service. It would have meant a lot to him.
Oh, thank you for doing this for me.
I'm not sure where to start. He was working off a disc, so... maybe Anna's original tapes might be one of these boxes.
Well, here.
He's gone.
Yeah. Well, maybe he'll be in touch.
I don't know. He said he'd made enough of a nuisance of himself while he was alive. It just doesn't make any sense. He was helping people.
Wow. He's go back years.
23, to be precise.
Carol should know. Tell Thomas he should. Men in the room. Oh. Now, here's one. $500 still there.
That's the kind of message I like.
Yeah.
As he leafs through a ledger of messages, a grim expression sweeps his face. Written in quotes are expressions such as, "Stop you, pig. She's ours." Pig, dot, dot, dot. Rot, dot, dot, dot. The word unclear is written in brackets afterwards. Another handwritten line says, "Stop you, pig, you bastard." There's rot, bastard, rot. Then the bitch. Again, the word unclear is written after it. Later at home, Jonathan is installing TV monitors and recording equipment. Empty boxes litter the room. His son Mike looks on bewildered.
Here we go.
Why do we got so many?
So you can watch your favorite show and I can watch my favorite show?
Looking bored, Mike cracks air bubbles on the plastic wrapping paper. That night, as Mike sleeps in his room at Jonathan's apartment, his teddy bear next to him, his father stays up using his new equipment, working through the night to try to get the messages he's become obsessed with. He sits amid a bank of untuned TV sets, feeding in videotapes and watching, constantly watching the white fuzzy screens of blankness. He's still there in the morning as Mike plays alone with his toys. He rubs his eyes in tiredness. When Mike's mother collects him, there's only a cursory wave goodbye between father and son. Jane looks disgruntled as she ushers Mike out of the door. He sits watching. He sleeps with the TV sets on. He wakes and he watches again. A photo of his wife's pretty face and a picture of them together remind him of his relentless quest. As his long vigil continues, he becomes animated and angry as the screens remain white, fuzzy, and barren. He paces, and in a fit of pique, he throws a remote control fiercely at a wall. Now he sits at a table in a high-backed chair with a dark-haired woman in her 30s. His hand rests on the tablecloth. Her hand grips his.
Okay. They're showing me something. Willow Avenue. They're showing me Willow Avenue. Yes?
No. No. No.
Huh. Okay. It's no problem. Sometimes it happens. Your wife. She passed over recently. Passing was difficult.
Yeah.
She was, she's a writer. She was a writer. Yeah, her words are important. Oh, I'm sorry, it's just the light is just, it's way too bright. It's like these tiny, noisy little pinpoints. It's making it hard to see anything at all.
A painful realization flickers on her face as she concentrates. She whips her hand from his in terror.
It's electronic voice.
Yeah, I know what this is.
She gets to her feet unsteadily.
Well, I've been making these tapes.
Yeah, you know, you shouldn't be trying this by yourself. It's not safe. It's like homemade Ouija boards and teenage seances at Halloween. EVP is not good. You have to understand that we spend years developing our relationships with our guides so that we can protect you.
From what?
From the ones who like damage. Because they are out there and they will find you. If you're gonna keep doing this, if you insist on meddling, then...
Anna, my wife, she sent me a sign. I just...
No, no, not Anna. You are misreading everything. Listen to me, it is one thing to contact the dead. It is another thing to meddle, and you are meddling.
He stares from his chair wide-eyed.
I just came because I wanted some help.
Okay, I know, I can help you. It's just that they are urging me to tell you to stop.
Right, thank you.
Mr. Rivers. Willow Avenue, are you sure they keep showing me Willow Avenue?
No. No Willow Avenue. No Willow Street. No Willow Terrace.
Mr. Rivers, she was pregnant. Yes?
He pauses on the hallway stairs, avoiding eye contact, before leaving the building. The water effect and the fountains outside Jonathan's apartment block. People stroll past on a walkway. A cyclist rides by. A car leaves the tree-lined car park. Inside his apartment, Jonathan checks videotapes before tossing them onto a table. On a TV screen, he watches the white noise with a resigned expression as he eats a sandwich and drinks from a mug. He turns to place his half-eaten sandwich on a plate and glances at two other screens. He quickly turns back again to the original.
Hey.
Vague, fuzzy shapes appear. He picks up a notepad. Jonathan drives away from the skyscrapers and office blocks in the city centre. He halts his 4x4 at a junction as a big truck takes the right of way. He pulls up next to an overgrown grass verge at the side of a rain-soaked road in the suburbs. He gets out and addresses a woman in the railed garden of a house. Inside the house, he shows her a fuzzy photograph from the television. She views it emotionally.
My mother died, giving birth to me. And like grandmother, she tried for years to make contact with her. You know, with candles, darkness, and smoke.
Seances.
Yeah. All of that. She tried everything.
She's in her 20s with long, dark hair.
Tell me. But when she died, she let me know she found her. She found my mother. Whenever I was sad, she would practically nab me to cheer up. She would say, Susie Thompson, look on the brighter side. Susie Thompson, lighten up. It's what she wanted me to know.
She stares at the barely recognizable photograph. Jonathan gives a nervous smile and glances at a frame photo of the woman and her gran displayed on a table. They walk down the steps from the house together as a lorry drives past.
Just like she didn't really die. I get the call from my father, and then what, like 2 days later, you come by? It's like she just carried straight on.
Susie, I don't understand. I've been getting messages from your grandmother for a week.
No, that can't be. She just passed away 2 days ago.
They exchange puzzled glances, she looking over the wooden railings of her garden, he standing next to his car. At Jonathan's apartment, Mike sits at a portable TV surfing channels. He switches from a cartoon program featuring ghosts.
Nothing out in the case of missing mother of two, Mary Freeman. It's been 9 days since she left her house to visit.
Jonathan sits at his bank of TV monitors and feeds in videotapes. A computer is also linked and registers the sound pattern. A red window on the computer flashes with the message recording. Mike gets down from the high stool next to his TV set and walks into the dining room from where the table has been commandeered.
Where are we going to eat now?
On our laps.
The little boy wanders into the room where his father sits at his electronic worktop, viewing the computer, which is flanked by the monitors.
Works.
What's that, Dad?
That means it's time for us to go pack up your gear. Come on, hit the road. 1, 2, 3. Hoi! That's it.
He picks Mike up and carries him.
Next week, can I watch a video and you watch a video like you said?
Yep, but only if you're good and ready for when your mom comes to pick you up.
Okay.
He plonks Mike on the sofa.
Daddy?
Yeah?
Are you gonna be okay?
Jonathan looks at his son, startled, but moved by the little boy's concern.
Yeah.
Clutching Mike's bag and his cuddly toy, Jonathan joins him on the sofa.
Promise.
He puts his arm around his son and kisses him on the head as they sit in a room that has an entire wall of glass. They face a table where family photos rest, along with a large canvas of painted flowers. As night begins to fall, the jets of water outside the apartment turn golden as the lights come on. From the outside, through the glass of Jonathan's apartment, his figure can be seen sitting in the workshop he's created of electronic equipment, watching a TV monitor, a notebook in his hand. He narrows his tired eyes as vague shapes appear. His mouth falls open. A hazy outline of a woman's face takes form. His eyes brim with tears as he touches the screen, smiling. The intermittent face of his wife becomes a little clearer through the fuzz. He leans into the screen, closing his eyes. He reels backwards in his chair in terror as the face of a demon with fangs springs at him as if trying to get through the screen. The face is instantly replaced by the white noise. Still in shock, he reaches for the remote control device but continues to stare at the screen. The indistinct face of Anna forms again. He switches off the recording and whips the tape into the computer-linked video machine. The voice patterns emerge as squiggly lines. He presses the keypad. A computer-generated sound mixer appears. He experiments to try to get the best sound reproduction. Dashes out, grabbing his car keys. He's driving along a narrow country lane, flanked by trees and illuminated by a silvery moon. His navigation aid flashes the words Willow Avenue, arrival alert. It's been raining and pools of water have formed at the sides of the lane. As he approaches a road junction, a sign confirms the information on his navigation aid. It says Willow Avenue. He stops the car and gets out, leaving the car door open and the headlights on. He stares around uncertainly. Over one side of the road, electric power cables sag between their supporting poles. In the distance, he sees a cascade of sparks coming from the top of one of the poles. As he walks towards it, another explosion of sparks lights the night sky. As he rounds a bend, he sees an overturned car, its headlights on, at the base of the pole. As he runs towards the crash vehicle, three ghostly shadows appear to be running away from it. Smoke fills the air as another explosion of sparks pelt down from the damaged electricity wires. He peers through one of the rain-stained windows of the car. It's dark inside. Suddenly, an injured woman with blood-stained hands presses herself at the window. Jonathan sees the baby in the wreckage, but is unable to reach it. It becomes a frantic race against time as he looks up to see that hot debris from the damaged pole is about to fall onto the car. Using brute force, Jonathan manages to open the rear door of the vehicle. He reaches inside and snatches the baby as electrical components crash down in a hail of sparks. At a safe distance with the baby in his arms, Jonathan glances back and sees the lifeless body of the woman slumped behind a shattered windscreen. Four pallbearers slowly carry a coffin decorated with flowers down the aisle of a church. Mourners somberly leave their pews and follow the walnut-veneered casket, including a man carrying the baby boy Jonathan saved. Jonathan stands at the back of the church with Sarah Tate. He steps towards the man with the child.
He's good. Gets a little better every day.
How are you?
Jonathan stares awkwardly as the man kisses his baby son.
I should. Sorry.
Yeah, okay.
Thanks again.
Mr. Black.
John.
Mr. Black.
I just. This is going to sound strange, but I need to tell you this. I went to the lab. Because of your wife. She reached out to me. She asked for help. That's the thing. She wanted help.
I am grateful for what you did, Mr. Rivers. I really am. My son wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you. So thank you. But now, I'd like you to leave us alone.
No, Mr. Black.
Carol may have believed your bullshit, but not me. So you and your sick friends, you stay the fuck away from me and my family. You understand? You stay away.
An exasperated Jonathan standing with Sarah in an almost empty church.
Number one, they're not dead. When I see them, they're not yet dead. Okay, so she's showing me things that haven't happened yet.
Anna's showing you things that haven't happened
yet. Right. Number two, she's showing me things that are here, not somewhere else, you know, where I can't do anything about it. She doesn't show me an earthquake in India or, you know, some bomb going off in the Middle East or something like that. They're right here in this city, right here where I can maybe do something. I've seen things that haven't happened yet. You understand?
Yeah, I can see how you're putting it together.
Putting it together? What do you mean how I'm putting it together? She wants me to help.
Jonathan stares pleadingly for understanding. Sarah looks back at him blankly. A woman collects prayer books. Jonathan sighs and sits in one of the pews. Sarah slowly moves to sit beside him. The priest emerges on the altar from the vestry.
I couldn't help Carol Black. I can help them.
The priest glances at the two of them as he walks past. Jonathan drives through nighttime traffic. The headlights reflect off the wet road. Ahead of him, a train passes over a bridge that spans the road. At his home, he continues his vigil.
Karen, can you cancel my appointments?
Sure.
For the next few days, please.
He replaces his phone on an open newspaper which carries a photograph of a dark-haired woman, Mary Freeman. The headline reads, "Police confirm missing woman abducted." His screens go blank. The screens reactivate, showing a brief, jumbled montage. He freezes the image on his computer. In one frame, there's a collection of vague lettering. In another, three ghostly figures stand side by side. He sits, unshaven, concentrating his weary eyes on the frame-by-frame playback. He sees the outline of a human hand. He dissects another frame and presses keys to zoom in. He can make out the face of a woman with imploring eyes. He stares at the screen, and the eyes stare back. The picture dissolves into fuzziness. Then the three figures are back. He plays back the voice through the computer sound mixer, reducing background noise. He watches the electronic voice squiggles. He scrolls down his computer menu until it reaches a file marked 0132. He clicks on this and the computer screen tells him he's opening a file of Anna's.
John, my love.
He replays the deeper voice, matching it with the one he's just heard.
It's the same voice.
He writes it in his notepad. Later, at Sarah's bookshop...
When I was at Raymond's listening to Anna's voice, he had been receiving these messages, these angry, violent messages. Now I'm getting the same thing, Sarah.
But from whom?
I don't know.
He crosses to the files kept by Raymond Price. From a row of videotapes, he plucks one marked with the name Edith Tomlinson.
Sarah. Edith Tomlinson, 207.
Sarah opens a ledger.
I was getting messages from Susie Tomlinson's grandmother, remember? Susie said her grandmother was trying to reach her dead daughter, Susie's mother.
Sarah's fingers scroll down a list of names.
Edith Tomlinson's daughter died giving birth, tapes 200-208.
Susie's grandmother. She was visiting Raymond.
Which is probably just a coincidence.
Look for Carol Black. Woman in the car. Remember what her husband said? My wife might have been into that shit, but I wasn't.
Sarah turns the pages. She looks down another list of names.
Carol Black. General interest tape number 231.
They exchange stares.
But Raymond had lists of clients. I mean, look at the ledgers. You've seen only two.
How do we know that? I've seen hundreds of faces, too. How do we know it's not the same at all?
Because I'm in there, you're in there, Edith Tomlinson,
no.
Carol Black.
No.
They're just two people.
There's too much
else. It's just a coincidence.
As he leafs through the ledger, a name leaps out at him. He stares at it in surprise. He points it out, almost speechless.
Mary Freeman. The missing woman.
She's on my tapes. I've seen her. She's on my tapes.
In deep thought, he leans on the rail of the gallery which overlooks the bookstore.
First they visit Raymond. Then I see them. Then they die.
A flashback to the newspaper photo of Mary Freeman, and then the face he saw on the screen.
John, what are you doing?
If she's alive, Anna will show her to me.
But we don't know that everyone you see on the tapes is alive.
Susie's grandmother? Carol Black.
Anna, what about Anna?
Anna's different. She's helping me.
We don't know what's happening here, John.
I do. If Mary Freeman's on any of these tapes, she might still be alive and we might have a chance to save her life.
As the video player whirs into playback mode, Sarah strolls to the glass wall in the next room to look at the skyline. Later, she sleeps on the sofa with her thick woolen scarf draped over her. All the time, Jonathan watches the monitor as he plays one tape after another.
Sarah! Sarah, come here! Look at this! Come here!
She wakes with a start. She joins him in the next room.
Come here. Look at this.
He replays a flickering, fuzzy recording.
Yeah, that? That's her. Oh my God. She's alive.
Go now!
Go where, lady?
John, I know you.
Wait, Anna, go where?
Please, John. Go!
Go. Go where, baby?
Go now!
Go where? She's gonna die.
You don't know that.
Don't know that. She's on the tape. She's on the tape. She's gonna die.
As he points his finger at the screen in utter frustration, his mouth opens in amazement. Sarah watches his face anxiously, then she slowly turns her head towards the TV screen. There's a flickering but clear black-and-white picture of her, Sarah. Her eyes are filled with fear.
It hurts.
They both stare almost in disbelief. Sarah can't bear to watch her own agony on the screen and moves away. Jonathan switches the image off. Later, Jonathan drives along an almost deserted downtown street with a backdrop of skyscrapers and other tall buildings, their lights illuminating the nighttime sky. He stops the car outside a 12-story block of neat apartments, each with its own balcony. Now high up in the apartment block, a shaken Sarah sits on her bed with a glass of water as Jonathan gets a tablet for her.
What if I don't wake up?
You will. I promise you will.
She pops the tablet into her mouth and takes a sip of water. Jonathan stands watching her with his back to the balcony curtains. He takes the glass from her and rests it on her bedside table as she lies on top of the bed.
You will stay with me.
Sure. Sure.
He takes her hand.
Promise.
Promise.
Thank you.
Still wearing her thick woolen scarf, she turns her head to the bedside table where there's a framed picture of her and the fiancé who died. The radio alarm clock reads 10:27. Jonathan steps onto the balcony and leans on the railings, glancing down at the light city traffic. On the street far below, a couple holding hands cross the road and step onto the wide pavement on Jonathan's side. They walk past the canopy which covers the entrance to the apartment block. With a jaded look, Jonathan rubs his eyes and goes back inside. Sarah is now sleeping peacefully on her bed covered by a blanket. A cushion rests on top of the blanket. In the same room, Jonathan has settled down to sleep on an armchair. He lies uncovered with his arms folded. He suddenly sits up. As Sarah turns in her sleep, he rubs his eyes wearily. He gets to his feet and crosses to the bedroom door. He props the door open with a silver ornament shaped like a candlestick. Holding his head, he goes into the bathroom. He switches the light on, leaving the door open. He glances around and sees the bathroom cabinet to the left of a big wall mirror. Inside, he finds what he's looking for, headache pills. He pops some into his mouth. He turns on the wash basin tap and bends to take a swig of water. He doesn't see three ghostly shapes that materialize for a split second in the corridor, but he heard the noise. He steps out of the bathroom and sees the bedroom door is shut. The ornament he propped it open with rolls on the floor. A look of dread flickers in his eyes as he opens the bedroom door. He turns the light on and sees the bed is empty. The light swings wildly on its cord from the ceiling, casting eerie shadows around the room. The wind blows open the balcony curtains. Through the gap, he sees Sarah standing on the ledge beyond the railings. Her blue eyes have a faraway look as she faces him. He stares in horror as she allows herself to fall backwards. He rushes onto the balcony and covers his face with his hands. Sarah crashes onto the glass-framed canopy roof on the ground floor. She lies motionless, Four passers-by rush to her aid. Jonathan stands in utter shock. A blurred image of a hospital ward with doctors and nurses going about their business. The picture clears to show Sarah lying on a bed with her eyes closed. An intravenous drip is attached to the back of her left hand. A machine at the bedside monitors her life signs. A doctor in a white coat talks to Jonathan. He pats his arm and Jonathan nods. When the doctor leaves, Jonathan crosses closer to Sarah's bed and stares at her bruised and battered face with concern. As Jonathan gets himself a coffee from a machine, the doctor talks to a detective. Jonathan approaches, holding his coffee.
That's as much as we can say right now. There's a 30-40% chance she might pull through.
Let's hope she's okay. Thanks again for your help, Doctor.
Okay.
Mr. Rivers.
Yeah.
Neighbors say they saw you on the balcony when Miss Tate fell. Is that true?
I was trying to stop her.
From falling?
Well, she's on the balcony.
Any idea why she was on the balcony?
I don't know.
All right. Well, I'll give you some time, but we'll need a full statement from you. Are you heading home soon?
Okay. I mean, I'm not leaving town, if that's what you mean.
Okay. I may come by later, then.
Yeah.
As Detective Smits leaves, Jonathan stands with his paper coffee cup, looking forlornly at Sarah. When the doctor leaves her bedside, he sits next to her bed.
John.
Hey. You're gonna be okay. You're gonna be fine.
Her eyes are open. She looks into his.
It hurts.
He stares grimly, recalling her earlier words.
It hurts.
As Jonathan drives from the underground car park, tears well in his red-rimmed eyes. He opens the door to his apartment, goes inside, and lets out a heavy sigh. He switches on the light and then stands still. His mouth falls open as he stares wide-eyed around the room. It's been wrecked. The debris is strewn around. Torn bits of paper float down from the ceiling. The panes of glass on the floor-to-ceiling window are shattered. He steps into his workroom, where there's more devastation. His electronic recording equipment litters the floor, along with his files. But in the midst of the chaos, one table has been left standing. On top is a flat-screen monitor. Jonathan crosses to it and sees it is playing a recording. On the bottom of the screen, the timer approaches 2:30. As he stares at the screen, a jumble of fuzzy letters appear.
No. Please, God. No.
More fuzzy pictures, and then he recognizes the location. He sees it in a flashback. It's beside the river where Anna died. Derelict warehouses line the bank, surrounded by fencing. He sees on the screen the petrified face of Mary Freeman. He dashes off, leaving the eyes staring in fear from the monitor. He drives furiously from the underground car park and into the city traffic. He overtakes whenever he can and wraps the steering wheel in frustration when he can't. Meanwhile, at his apartment, the monitor screen continues to play its flickering, fuzzy pictures. Now it shows three ghostly figures. Through a frosted glass dividing wall at the apartment, the shadows of three figures flit past. With headlights blazing, Jonathan speeds through an industrial estate. Back at his apartment, Detective Smits finds the door open and walks in.
Mr. Rivers?
Dressed in a leather jacket and white shirt, he surveys the scene of devastation at the apartment. He notices the TV monitor on a table flickering away. He moves towards it and stares in surprise at the fuzzy image of the frightened woman. Jonathan speeds along a rain-soaked road in his 4x4. He's reached the quayside he recognizes from the fuzzy pictures. He halts the vehicle and climbs out, leaving the door open. He runs towards the edge of the water, which reflects the lights from a long steel jetty accommodating tall cranes and heavy lifting gear. He stares and paces. It's a vast area, and he doesn't know where to start his search. He grimaces. He looks towards the lights at the other side of the wide river. He turns and paces back to his car. A notice on a steel mesh gate ahead of him says, "Keep out." At the other side, a notice warns, "This gate must be kept locked at all times." Through the security fence, he sees lettering similar to the lettering that kept appearing on his monitor screens. He goes closer to the gate and notices a light coming from an upper window of the derelict warehouse inside the fence. He attempts to open the gate, but it's securely locked. Barbed wire lines the top. He wrestles with the fence where it joins the gate and manages to force it open enough to climb through. Back at his apartment, Detective Smiths is reading one of Jonathan's notebooks. He puts it down with a look of consternation. He starts to leave, but stops to answer his mobile phone.
Hello. Hello.
I'm at Pier 16. Can you hear me, Smiths? Damn it.
Jonathan is running along an alleyway between two buildings. He enters one of the buildings where water pours down from the ceiling to the floor, where it forms in pools. He yanks rotting wood from a locked door and goes into another part of the warehouse. He strides up stone steps into an extensive area where pillars support the roof. Paint peels from the stark, discoloured walls. Water drips constantly onto the concrete floor. He pauses, looks around, and listens attentively for a few moments. He moves on to a part of the building where water cascades down from on high and graffiti marks the dilapidated brickwork. He stares upwards as he stands below a large shaft which stretches up to the roof of the building. On each side of the shaft there are other levels where the concrete floors stop abruptly. He notices that the pouring water is reflecting a flickering white light as it cascades down. The light is coming from one of the higher floors and forms a shimmering beam through the dust and water. He sets off to find the source of the light, past a huge steel chute and up some wide steps to the upper levels. He paces through another vast area of floor space and cautiously approaches a side which is curtained off with sheets of hanging plastic. Through the plastic he can see white light. He pulls the curtains apart and steps through. On a table, there are banks of TV monitors, each flickering white. There's a stack of video recording machines and a computer. It's all similar to the equipment he uses at home. Desk lights glow at each end of the table, which is littered with videotapes. A fly eats leftovers from a plate, also on the table. A figure passes behind Jonathan. He's unaware and squats down for a closer look at the equipment. He's about to press a button. He reels back sharply on hearing the scream. He rushes to where the shaft is and sees light as he stares upwards. The ghostly image of Anna appears on a wall high above him. It starts to fade, but becomes clear again.
Anna.
Never taking his eyes off the spectre, he moves closer.
Anna, you have to help me, please. Anna, you have to help me find Mary.
Please, John. Please, John. Go now. Go now. Go now.
Behind him, the TV sets start flickering. Three fuzzy figures appear on all the screens. Jonathan's eyes are still on Anna. He glances from the fading ghost on the wall to where the scream came from, confusion and uncertainty sweeping his face. He makes his decision. He runs through the building and up a staircase to a higher level. He passes stone pillars where water gushes down. He stops and looks with apprehension at the jagged blade of a circular saw. He steps slowly towards a table where a variety of tools are neatly laid out. They include a vise, a cleaver, and pliers. Also on the table, an assortment of bottles containing different solutions. Jonathan stares with unease and suspicion. He slowly and cautiously walks away from the table. Through partially drawn sheets of plastic, he sees a woman with her arms strapped to a chair. She wears jeans and a blue shirt, her wedding rings on her left hand. As he steps closer, he recognizes the woman's terrified eyes. Sweat is pouring down her face. As Jonathan walks through the curtains, a man in a blue check jacket comes into view. He has a moustache and several days' growth of beard. He stands with his back to the woman facing Jonathan. He holds tools in his hand.
They talked to me, John. This was their idea. All their idea.
He looks up and Jonathan turns to follow his gaze. He sees in the distance three demonic figures looking through the cascading water in their direction. An horrific sense of realization flickers in Jonathan's eyes.
She was beautiful, John. I brought her to them. They were very pleased with me.
Arbell Avenue suggests she may have slipped into the river while...
Damage to the head, a break to the arm.
This was their idea.
You guys okay?
In a flashback, he remembers the face of the torturer, the workman he saw after being trapped in the lift.
No!
A demon launches itself at Jonathan. In hospital, Sarah's eyes flicker open. A clock ticks to 2:30 and stops. In her mind, Sarah can see the swirling demons attacking Jonathan and smashing his body. The workman smiles maniacally as he watches. Sarah twists, turns, and writhes in her bed. Now a TV set with flickering white noise switches off. The terrified, pleading eyes of the captive Mary Freeman stare out at the workman as he moves closer, whistling as he does so. His body jerks as he slumps to the floor. He's shot by a team of police snipers. They're led by Detective Smits, who shines his torch on the face of the dead workman. Sir. Smits joins colleagues who are shining lights down the shaft in the building. Lying on a slab at the bottom, the body of Jonathan, his left leg twisted backwards, his arms outstretched. Blood runs from his mouth. Water cascades down on him. Under a clear blue sky, mourners have gathered in a large cemetery peppered with trees.
O God of grace and glory, we remember before you this day our brother Jonathan. Give us faith to see in death the gate of eternal life, so that in quiet...
Some stand and others sit at the graveside. A black ebony coffin rests next to a tarpaulin which covers the grave. On the coffin lid, a wreath of red roses, white lilies, heather, and a single pink carnation. The priest in his long black cassock and snow-white surplice bows his head in remembrance. Jane sits comforting a sad-looking Mike. Away from the main body of mourners, Sarah sits in a wheelchair under the shade of a tree. Some mourners return to their cars, parked in one of the narrow roads that crisscross the cemetery. Jane gives Mike a hug in the back seat of her car before getting into the front passenger seat. She removes her dark glasses and exchanges a somber glance with a man in the driving seat. Suddenly, the car radio switches itself on. The digital indicator shows it's surfing the FM channel. With a mixture of disquiet and astonishment, Jane turns to look at Mike.
I'm sorry, Mikey.
Jane turns the radio off. Looking shaken, she puts her dark glasses on again. Her cheeks are tear-stained, but she manages to smile at Mike, who meekly returns the gesture. The driver pulls away. From her wheelchair, now on the road, Sarah watches the car go over a hill and out of sight, but she continues to stare wistfully, her face filled with puzzlement and sadness. A sudden wind blows up. Sarah switches her gaze to a tall tree as the branches start to rustle. Unseen by her, three shadowy figures appear and then vanish. Through the white noise now on the screen, a fuzzy picture of Jonathan materializes. Of the many thousands of documented EVP messages, approximately 1 in 12 have been overtly threatening in nature. The end.
Last time I talked to you, you were lonely and out of place. You were looking down on me, lost out in space. Laid underneath the stars, strung out and feeling brave. Watch the red orange glow, watch you float away. Garbage and city lights. You're gonna save your tired soul. You're gonna save our lives. I turned on the radio to find you on satellite. I'm waiting for the sky to fall. I'm waiting for a sign. And all we are is all so far. I can't see, yeah. I know you're out. miss your purple hair. I miss the way you taste. And now you'll come back someday on a bed of nails away. I'm praying that you don't burn out or fade away. And all we are is all so fine. Can't see. Now you're left.